when you start the project, start with, you're not allowed to say, we've always done it this way.
We rightly celebrate the struggles of startups and their brave founders, but it can be tough working in a bigger company too, where powerful corporate antibodies seek and destroy new ideas that don't conform to the conventional culture. But some leaders battle the status quo inside their own companies to innovate and drive change. These are the serial entrepreneurs, and this is their story.
Dion Lyle with Capgemini.
So, Dion, tell me your story. I mean, what's your career arc been like?
My career arc has been a bit jumbly. I went from being what appeared to be someone who jumped around too much to being a Renaissance man to being in the right place at the right time. Early in my career, I was in technology, JP, and it's interesting because I loved new and different and being what I call tip of the spear. And it led me to change jobs, quite frankly, too often.
Well, what'd you major in college?
Hotel restaurant management, of course.
You're perfectly applicable.
It was a business degree, but it was in hotel restaurant management.
Now, were you that all the way through or did you change majors?
No, all the way through.
So what did you want to be? Why did you choose that major?
So originally I wanted to be a chef, and then I found out it's really hard work and you become an alcoholic and die young. So I changed career trajectories. And then I decided management was the way to go. And then all my friends in hotel management never saw their families on holidays. They worked constantly and it just seemed really hard. And I was too lazy for that.
Yeah. So are you still a chef? You still like to cook?
Funnily enough, I love to cook at home, but I have two teenage boys now and their tastes run from bland to blander. So the opportunities to make coq au vin for teenage boys are pretty limited, I'm afraid. So I don't cook at home as much as I or my wife would like to.
Yeah. So you take a degree in hospitality management. You start as a chef. You become a management person there, and you're not liking the lifestyle and the hours. So what comes next?
Yeah. So I actually started with a printed circuit board company. I stumbled into an opportunity to be the administrative manager of a small division of a company.
And how did you think you could do that job?
I had no business getting that job. It was the weirdest interview I've ever had, JP. It was 9 o'clock at night. And I meet this guy at this office and I'm already thinking sketchy. And they had this management training program. And he said, well, you're a little overqualified for that. And I said, I just graduated. Like, I'm not overqualified for anything. He said, well, you seem more mature than the other guys. Why don't you be in charge of administration? And I'm like, what does that mean? He said, personnel, purchasing, accounting. I'm like, sure. So I took the job and started doing it.
So printed circuit boards. So like who were their customers? What kind of?
Yeah, great question. So Rockwell, other what's called mil spec. So it was in Southern California. So you did a lot of military spec work. And it was literally dipping pieces of material into chemical baths, pulling them out, polluting the environment in the process, and then delivering the base of every electronic device. Yeah. If you open up any electronic device, there's a green sheet inside.
Right.
That's a printed circuit board. That's what we made.
Right. So for all kinds of uses.
Yeah, absolutely. Consumer, audio, you know, anything. Anything you could think of that's electronic has a printed circuit board in it. And we did fast turn prototype for the military and for government and for commercial applications.
So what did you learn from that job that you were able to carry forward?
You know what? Fake it till you make it. That was the main thing I learned. As I said, JP, I had no business in that job. I ran an accounting department. I had to hire an accounting manager. I think I was 24 at the time, and I hired a 35-year-old guy to be my head of accounting. And honestly, I just faked it till I made it. And just if you act confident, people will give you the respect and let you do what you want to do. And they did.
So how long were you in that job then?
I was there for probably 3 or 4 years. And I moved with them from Southern California back up to my home in Northern California, where I'm originally from. And then I started to do sales operations up there. And I realized I didn't want to be in administration because I was on a CFO track. And anyone who knows me now would laugh at the thought of me being a CFO. So I moved over to the sales marketing side of the house.
And how did that go?
It was interesting. I opened a sales office in Boston area on Route 128. I think it was called Brookline. And then I just did various things around sales marketing. I just liked the outbound nature of that end of the business rather than the inbound nature of being a CFO or an accountant or HR or purchasing.
Right. Yeah. So what came next then after this role?
Yeah, so this is, it gets a little bit wonky. I mean, I don't know how long your podcast is, but we probably don't have time for every shift in my weird career. But basically, I stayed outbound. I went into sales. I did sales for a while. Really enjoyed that. Worked inside of Documentum, Interwoven, some of the early, you know, internet players. I actually, my first sales job was with Compton's New Media, selling encyclopedias, oddly enough, to OEM manufacturers.
Yeah.
So my first sales job.
Kind of encyclopedia salesman.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Not the door-to-door, but it felt like it sometimes. And so I worked on getting CDs into personal computer boxes as part of an OEM package with Compaq and back in the day, Dell, Packard Bell, some of the other names you don't hear anymore. So, so it was interesting. I enjoyed, again, the outbound nature. And but I also realized I had to move upstream into the enterprise part of the business.
Yeah. So where'd that take you?
So that took me to Documentum originally, then Interwoven, a startup in between, and then a company called Valicert, which is where I got into public key infrastructure and being on the technical side of a business, or the sales side of a technical business, I should say. And that was really interesting because that's where I started to learn about banks. So I started to sell to banks and work with banks on their technical solutions and trying to make those more understandable for the bankers rather than just the IT people inside of banks. And my trajectory since then has been pretty steady of, you know, be the Rosetta Stone between those two worlds, you know, talk
between the banks and the
banks and tech. Exactly. Yeah. Right, JP. So it was basically about connecting the two dots between, hey, the technologists don't understand how to talk to bankers and bankers don't understand technology. How can I meld those two worlds? And I've been spending the last probably, God, embarrassing to say, 16, 17 years doing that.
Right. So, which is the whole theme of this podcast, right? How do we get things done inside the enterprise? And you've been a serial entrepreneur inside a lot of different companies, and you work with entrepreneurs inside of companies. I mean, what are the common traits of successful entrepreneurs?
I think a couple. One, tenacity. Just like an entrepreneur, you have to be tenacious. You have to not take no as an answer. I think the greatest thing I've ever heard for an entrepreneur or even a team working on some internal innovation is when you start the project, start with, you're not allowed to say, we've always done it this way.
Right.
Take that off the table and things go a lot better.
That's a death sentence already, right?
Exactly. Yeah. The number one impediment to innovation is internal culture. And you and I both know banks on a bell curve, maybe insurance is slower. But for the most part, I'm lucky. I'm in Silicon Valley. So I see Google. I see Twitter. I see Facebook. I see the innovators. And some of those companies have gotten quite large, and yet they still try to stay innovative. Size is definitely a detriment to innovation, as anyone in the government or military will tell you. But I think the key is to always have that, we've always done it this way is not acceptable. Start with that base.
So were you always kind of a groundbreaker like that, or did you have to learn that in your career on how to forge your own path instead of do it the way we always did it?
So funnily enough, I've always done it, but I didn't package it or label it that way. And if I had known that about myself earlier, I probably would have had a more sensible career track. But I was in Compaq's first independent business unit way back in the day.
What was that?
It was called the Prolinia. It was a line of computers. It was the low-cost line of computers, which today seems ridiculous.
Right.
But at the time was groundbreaking for Compaq computers. And we got set up out in the warehouse, and away from the main marketing teams of personal computers at Compaq. And I loved it. And I should have recognized it then so that I could continue that trajectory.
What did you like best about that?
That's a great question. I'll tell you the story was my office, I overlooked a conveyor belt in the warehouse. So I would see boxes go by every day.
Yeah.
So at the end of the
day, you knew whether you were shipping or not, right?
Exactly right, JP. I was like, I had a great day at the office. How do you know? Because I saw 1,000 boxes go by my window. How was your day? Not so good. I only saw 100 go by.
Right.
Being close to the business and what really matters and the KPIs around what customers are doing and what's important, that's what I loved. And that's what I should have recognized and tracked and chased after for the rest of my career. I did it accidentally, so there were fits and stops, but that was the moment where I realized what I loved.
Yeah. So were you always the one pushing the envelope then? And it sounds like maybe that was something you kind of learned and evolved into over time.
Yeah, but it really stemmed from a personality defect. It's just ADHD. I just get bored easily.
Yeah. So you want something new.
I want the new, exciting, different. I hate bureaucracy. I bristle at rules. And I'm not a rebel by any means, but I just bristle at those boundaries. And I just think there's a better way.
So you must have hit the wall at some point, right? That personality doesn't always work. And, you know, you're a little older now, you've got some success, and you can probably deal with that pretty confidently. But when you were younger, when was the first time you really, you know, hit what I like to call the business prevention department?
Yeah. The VP of no, as we called it at Citibank. Yeah. Far too often. I would say probably in the job at Compaq, quite honestly. Yeah. I mean, I saw it there. And yeah, full credit to those large organizations that achieve a lot, billions in revenue or trillions in assets. You have to give them credit. They got there by doing things a certain way. And yet I always believed next was best, right? I always believed the next way to do it is the better way to do it. So I always strive towards that. It's not always easy to do.
Yeah. So was there a specific time you remember when somebody said, Dion, slow down here. You're moving too fast.
I'd like to say there was, but honestly, I don't remember a time where someone didn't say that. I've always been a bit of an antibody inside of corporations. If you look at my LinkedIn, you'll see this amazing pattern of startup, big company, startup, big company, startup, yeah. Big company. Quite a bit of that.
So what's that say to you?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of people would say, oh, it means you're a startup guy. But I love big companies, what they're capable of, the scale, the reach, the globality. I mean, I love that. And yet I get frustrated with the bureaucracy and the rules and the bounds. And so what it says is I have skills for both. I'd love to say I'm really good at both. I've done both quite a bit. I like both, which maybe that's how I ended up where I am now.
So when you make a change, then is it a matter of maybe those are kind of two countervailing itches and you need the startup itch for a while and then you go, okay, this is great, but now I need some scale.
That's exactly right. Which if you mix in a wife who says, hey, a more steady income would be good and better insurance would be good too.
Yeah.
Then you can understand the every 2 to 3 years making a shift. I mean, my longest job, I think, has been 4 years.
Yeah. Yeah. So increasingly, that's becoming more common, more acceptable, and even encouraged.
Yes.
But early in your career, maybe not so much.
Oh, it was definitely a detriment. I can remember being very embarrassed by my resume for years. And I don't know when it happened, 5, 6 years ago, maybe. To your point, it was in vogue. Suddenly, yeah. And like I like to say, I was just a thought leader around moving around.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you were the serial entrepreneur at multiple companies. So how do you lead and motivate younger people now? And same thing, people come into a company and I think many times, even those who have that, you know, rebellious streak inside them, they want to keep their job and they want to please the boss. So they want to kind of do what's acceptable, but yet we do need them to shake it up and try new things. How do you encourage that in other people?
That's a great question. I'm a bit of a hypocrite because I get frustrated with millennials and the way they want to change things right away. And I often say to people, you don't have to change the company you joined on day one. You know, you can do it over time. Try to be, you know, a river over a rock over a period of time instead of just a bolt of lightning into a system. And I always say, and I have the perfect stance to say it, which is I tried that. I failed. Learn from me.
Yeah.
Don't have the battle scars I have. Do it smarter. Do it better.
Was there a pivotal moment where you really learned that lesson where you tried one too many times to be the lightning bolt and you got turned into a rock in the river?
Yeah. There was a moment at Citibank and my boss at Citibank, Jeff Semenchuk, was fantastic, a real mentor of mine. And he's not a bank guy, actually. He's an innovation guy. And I remember at the end of my first year, he said, Dion, fantastic job this year. Everyone in the Valley knows you. You have great contacts. You really know the financial services. He said, nobody at Citibank knows you. He said, you've really got to look internal if you're going to change how we operate and who we are.
Right.
And at that moment, I realized I was trying too hard to not be a banker,
right.
Which, as you've heard me say before, JP, I take a lot of pride that I worked for a bank, wasn't a banker. But the fact is, he was right. I had to look internal if I was going to affect change. I had to influence internal constituents instead of just, hey, everyone outside really thinks you're doing great stuff.
Yeah. So a big part of being an entrepreneur is not having all the greatest ideas necessarily. It's how do you influence people around you to make change? And so to his point, it was you didn't have enough relationships or connections with people to be able to have influence internally.
That's exactly right. And I had people who, and it was funny, I joined Citibank as I would from a startup, OboPay, after I had done a deal between Citibank and OboPay. And the minute I did the deal, everyone at OboPay, the startup, was like, oh, you're a big dumb banker. Like, I've been here 10 minutes. How dumb could I have gotten?
Yeah.
And everyone inside of Citibank was like, oh, you're that Wild West guy from Silicon Valley. You're gonna bring the bank to its knees. Like, you overrate my influence.
Right.
I'm one mid-level guy at a bank. I don't think I could do that much damage if that was my goal. But what I realized was it is about influence, both inside and out.
So what did you do with his advice then? How did you start to build those connections and build that influence internally?
Well, I actually achieved it through frequent flyer miles because I'm in California, Citibank's in New York.
Right.
So I got on United Airlines every other week and I did get global services status out of it. So there was that plus. And the W Hotel in New York knew me very well. But I basically just made appearances and just inserted myself into meetings, met with people, talked to people, engaged with people. And I tried to develop a begrudging respect for what they brought to the table.
So is that advice you would give to others?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would love to save people the trouble of that first year of flashing about thinking you were doing all the right things and realizing the organization that pays your check didn't see the impact. So it's not as useful as you'd like to believe.
Right. Right. What other advice do you have for entrepreneurs?
Well, it depends. I mean, one thing I was telling, I was at a large financial services firm the other day and a very young person, I mean, really young, said, hey, I want to stand out here, but I get frustrated with the bureaucracy. I said, well, my advice to you is to find a swim lane, right? So maybe it's host a hackathon. None of your VPs are hosting hackathons. Host a hackathon.
Find some open space. Where
exactly. Find something that's not claimed. Exactly. And the thing is, JP, no EVP of banking at whatever bank wants to host a hackathon. If you can and you know how. I had a friend do this at Citibank. He raised his hand when social media was a big deal. And all of a sudden, he owned social media, right? All you have to do is be in the room, raise your hand, know a little bit about it. And if it's nobody else's swim lane, knock yourself out.
Right. So you mentioned your prior boss. Who else has been an inspiration to you, either directly or indirectly? Maybe it's a leader at another company you've kind of looked at from afar.
Yeah. I would say, this is going to sound funny, a gentleman named John Thompson I've always held up as a great example. He's graduated from a predominantly black university, FAMU, Florida A&M. He was CEO and eventually chairman of Symantec. He's now chairman of Microsoft. And I always loved that he went about his business, never made a deal that he was a minority or an African American, but just had this amazing trajectory of a career while just being a guy who does a great job inside of large organizations. He had a 20 plus year career at IBM, then Symantec, and then became chairman of Microsoft. And you don't hear anyone talk about him. And he's the kind of person who's very low key and quiet and beneath the fervor, but just amazing. I mean, I really respect someone like that.
Have you ever gotten to meet him?
No, directly? You know, it's funny. I worked at Compaq and I worked with a guy named John Thompson, different John Thompson. And he used to laugh because they used to get they both overlapped at IBM and they used to get their mail mixed up back in the day when people used mail.
Right.
And I remember him telling me about him. And then I looked up and I've just followed his trajectory ever since. And I've just never ceased to been impressed with how he just goes about the business.
Yeah. So what else besides his kind of quiet competence and his success, is there anything that's
not gonna lie
out?
That he's a minority.
Yeah.
And look,
somebody with some even additional hurdles and
headwind,
of them.
Let's call it.
Headwind. Yeah.
He had a headwind that I didn't have.
Right.
And I've been to enough industry events, as have you. It's unusual to see black executives at industry events and yet never made a deal out of it. Yeah. It was never written up that way. He was always just quiet, competent, really good executive.
Well, you know, you bring up something really interesting in this. Notion of diversity is important in its own regard, but I'm a big believer that if you're going to be innovative, you need a diversity of viewpoints, you need a diversity of perspectives from all different kinds of people. And how have you incorporated that into your kind of management style and the way that you've driven change inside of companies?
Yeah, good question. At Citibank, I had a gal that worked for me, Jennifer. She was fantastic. And I've mentored her ever since. We're still close contact today, you know, 7-8 years later. I just hired someone on my team to head up blockchain, a very technical implementation. And full disclosure, I found the best person for the job, but I found a woman who was the best person for the job because I believe exactly as you said, which is if you're going to have diversity of solutions, you need diversity of thought. And if we all have the same lens and background, it's not going to work.
Right, right. So do you have any favorite business books?
Oh, that's a great question. I read quite a bit. I went through a period of reading about ethnic conflict of all bizarre things. I was just fascinated by that for a while. I don't read that many business books, to be quite honest. I mean, back in the day, I remember Seven Habits of Highly Effective People.
Right.
Classic. Just loved it. Read that. I recently read a book, and I don't remember the exact title, but it was about cryptocurrency and kind of how that's going to affect our economic times in the future. And that was really interesting.
Yeah.
But pure business books, I don't actually read that many.
Okay.
I read more World War II history and diverse things.
Yeah.
Keep my mind fresh.
So the history, can be just interesting or pleasurable. I mean, do you draw lessons out of that too?
Yes, absolutely. One of the things I always like to say is the reason that World War II took so long, the first half was fought by World War I generals.
Right.
Right.
And World War I tools and weapons.
Exactly. That's exactly
and
it.
And tactics.
When you attack tanks with a cavalry, you're on the wrong side of history.
Right.
When you attack tanks, you know, or when you attack airplanes with tanks, you're on the wrong side of history. So every generation of battle tactics, which is a lot of history, has a lesson for all of us about innovation and how you have to think ahead. There was one book I read about the Cold War with Russia, very timely now, unfortunately. But one of the things when nuclear power became available, one of our greatest air generals wanted a nuclear powered bomber. And I was curious about that. And what he meant was he wanted a bomber that would never land, just go forever.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, what very smart people pushed him aside and did was build our missile program, which not a great thing, but I'm glad we have it.
Right.
It's a great deterrent. But the fact is the original Air Force general who liked bombers said, let's just make a new bomber instead of changing the technology landscape to missiles. Again, a perfect metaphor for what we see in banking, we see in technology, we see in automobiles. Don't hold on to the previous generation for too long.
Well, and we always start with framing new ideas and new technology through what we know already. I often talk about, you know, the first car we called a horseless carriage, and it was built that way, right? With space outside the cabin for, you know, the driver to be out front, and it eventually evolved. It will continue to evolve as we're moving to driverless cars. You know, that's probably not the right word either.
Yeah. That's a great point. Every time, and look, I'm guilty of it myself. There's these new photos circulating of a car with four seats that swivel and you can face each other.
Facing one another.
And every time I see it, I'm like, how the hell do you drive?
Right.
Oh, wait, you're not supposed to drive that. Okay.
Right.
I'm not there yet. Full disclosure. I'm not ready for that.
Well, the world's not there yet, but some people are driving that.
Exactly.
Is there a phrase or kind of a saying you have tacked up on your wall or something that kind of guides your principles or your business philosophy?
There's one I love. It can be applied to business. I'm not sure it's originated that way. It's Edmund Burke once said, in order for evil to prosper, all you need is good men to do nothing. And I'm paraphrasing, of course. And I've always thought, what a great quote, because whenever I look at evil happen, it's because people stood on the sidelines. Now, evil's, of course, horrible, but I would say the same is true in innovation. In order for non-innovation to happen, just stand on the sidelines. It won't happen. You have to insert yourself in the process, whether it's political, whether it's innovation in a bank or a new startup. You have to insert yourself in the process. So that's probably my favorite quote for sure.
Yeah, that's a great one. Good. What else? Anything you want to talk about that?
I think what's exciting today, you know, walking around here at Money 2020 Europe and generally as I visit banks and fintechs and I talk to both sides of the table, I find it very interesting the lack of understanding on both sides. Like I worked on a project last summer where a large bank who shall remain nameless required a startup to have more liability insurance. They said, oh, you have $1 million, you need three.
Right.
And I said, why three?
And this is probably a multi-billion dollar bank.
Right? Completely. They wouldn't have known what to do with $1 or $3 million if they actually executed on that part of the contract. And yet they were steadfast in having to have the up in insurance. And could not get them to understand why that was a non-issue. And they just kept coming back to, well, procurement said so. That's a horrible way to run a business. Conversely, when I was at Obopay and we signed the deal with Citibank and we didn't know how to do a rule book, that too, which is why I often say the job I'm trying to do at Capgemini is to be a Rosetta Stone between those two worlds, because I've been in both. I've been in fintech startups, love it. I've been in big banks, love it. I'm just trying to close that, what I call the innovation collaboration gap. Banks want to innovate. They just don't know how. Fintechs want to collaborate. It's just too hard. So I'm trying to close that gap. That's really what I'm focused on.
Well, I'm driven by that too. I think that what we're seeing in fintech and financial services right now is, you know, really unprecedented opportunity for that kind of collaboration that you describe. But it's not limited to financial services either. I think every single mature company right now in every industry is facing disruption. And, you know, one of my favorite sayings is William Gibson, you know, the future's already here. It's not widely distributed yet. And I kind of add my own version of that is disruption is already here. It's just not widely distributed yet. So all of the incumbents who say, well, we don't really have to worry about that. These other guys, what they're doing is very small and it's not impacting us. They may be right for now, but over time, they're probably not.
Objects in the mirror are larger than they appear.
That's another good one.
Right. And that's exactly the point. And so Capgemini, I'm in the FS business, but we have
financial
other
services.
And specifically banking within the FS group. But we have other businesses and they do visit us. And I do get exposed to like Airbus and major merchants and so on and so forth. And what I find very interesting is all these businesses are under this same pressure of how do I innovate? And all you have to say is, if you're a merchant and you didn't see Amazon coming, they didn't take your business. You gave it to them.
Yeah. Well, and it's only getting worse now, right?
Completely. And I tell FS people this all the time. If you're a bank, forget the fintechs. What's Amazon doing? What's Google doing? What's Apple doing?
Right.
That's where I would focus my efforts.
Right.
And by the way, they have billions in R&D budget that they spend to attack the edge of your business.
Right.
What are you doing to attack theirs or to even protect your own?
And we have virtually zero R&D spending in financial services.
That's actually one of the webinars I did recently is I say, take advantage of Silicon Valley's $15 billion in fintech investment. That's your outsourced R&D budget because you have zero. Apple, Google, all of these people, they spend 15 to 20% of earnings on R&D. Greenfield. Don't even know what it is yet. And they're willing to spend billions of dollars a year on it.
So as we talk about other industries, is there an industry you think is doing particularly well at adapting innovation and or partnering with younger companies?
Honestly, not that I've seen, but I have a funny lens on innovation. I was telling someone at a major FI the other day, my favorite innovation of the last decade is the upside down ketchup bottle.
Right.
Absolutely brilliant.
It
didn't
solves
have to
a
change
problem.
A thing.
Right.
Solved a consumer problem easily. And all you did was turn the label upside down and make the cap a little wider. And voila, you've got the upside down ketchup bottle. It's brilliant.
So to your point, that was a very incremental innovation, but you find it valuable. Do you think there is some kind of snobbery around, oh, that innovation isn't big enough, isn't cool enough? Is that a problem in our industry?
Completely. Citibank, I guess I will say it. At Citibank, we were working with a startup, Obopay, and one of the analysts came back and said, there's a typo in the spreadsheet. And I said, oh, I'm really sorry. Let me take a look. And I kept looking and looking. I'm not great at spreadsheets, but I didn't see it. And then he said, oh, wait, it's just an order of magnitude problem. He goes, I thought it was billions. It's millions.
Right.
I'm like, yeah, we're a 25-person startup.
Right.
That number would not be billions.
Yeah.
So there is that scale issue, JP. And I do think there's a snobbery around it, but it catches everyone off guard. When I was at First Data, we looked at Stripe and we're like, yeah, they're eating the edges of the business, but we'll see.
It's a classic innovator's dilemma.
The number of times it happens, it seems inexcusable by now. It should be a crime by now to ignore those edge of the business innovation. And yet you and I have seen it so many times, we can't even count the examples anymore.
Right. Good. Well, Dion, thanks for being here. This has been great.
It was my pleasure, JP. Have a great one.
I'm JP Nichols. This has been the Serial Entrepreneur Podcast. If you like the show, please give it a 5-star rating. That really helps other people discover it. You can also learn more and support this and all the other great podcasts from Provoke Media at provoke.fm.